Welcome home, neighbors. This is Jeremy from Louisville, Kentucky, owner at the Polynesian Villas and Bungalows, and you're listening to My DVC Points.
Parents and the children could have fun together.
Please board quickly and safely. Our monorail will be departing momentarily.
Welcome to the My DVC Points podcast. Join the conversation as DVC members share their stories, personal preferences, and magical memories. Your reservation is confirmed, your fast passes are booked, pull up on the yellow strap because our journey into the magic of membership is about to begin.
To infinity and beyond.
Now, here's your host and curator of magical stories, Chad Pennycuff.
Welcome home, neighbors, to episode 107 of the My DVC Points podcast. Today's show is brought to you by our friends over at DVCResaleMarket.com. If you're looking to buy or you're looking to sell, DVC Resale Market is the world's leader in DVC resale. They have hundreds of years combined experience selling DVC properties. Every single person that's on their team is a former Disney Direct Guide. And what that means is you can get that Disney level of experience without having to pay that Disney price tag. DVCResaleMarket.com. Let them know you heard about them here on the My DVC Points podcast. I'm really excited to bring you today's show. I know a lot of our listeners listen into this podcast to learn about Disney Vacation Club, and they kind of think of me as somewhat of a DVC mentor, teaching them some of the ropes. Well, in today's episode, we're talking with my friend, Dan Cockrell, and I'm a huge fan of his podcast, Come Rain or Shine. And Dan is my Thursday morning mentor on my commute to work and has been for 100 episodes now. I'd like to welcome to the show my friend and mentor, Dan Cockrell. Dan, how are you doing today?
Good, Chad. How are you today?
I am doing great on this Friday morning.
Thanks for having me.
Dan, let's walk through a little bit of your history. The fans have seen the outcome and appreciated some of your life work here. So why don't you tell me a little bit about your career history and where you've been and how you've been working through Disney and transitioning away from there?
Yeah, so it was basically my whole adult life was spent at Disney. Worked there in college, parking. At the time I was working at the Contemporary Hotel, checking people in at the front desk on the Walt Disney World College program. And then 2 years later, after I graduated, I came back down to Walt Disney World and I had a political science major. And so they said, well, what do you want to do? I said, well, I don't know. I have a political science major. What should I do? And they said, you should park cars. I said, all right, let's do that. So I parked cars at Epcot for about 6 months. And then I got into the management training program. This was 1991. So this was a year before Disneyland Paris was opening, Euro Disney at the time. And so I was able to get a work visa through college and had the opportunity to go to France and open the parking lot because that's what my expertise was in. And I got there in January 1992, and we opened the park in April 12th, 92. I mean, I tell people how clueless I was at the time. You know, just gotten out of college. I really didn't speak French. I'd never been in a leadership role like that. So there was a lot coming at me, but those moments really make you better. They make you much more flexible, how to deal with stress. And ended up, the plan was to go for a year and a half, and my visa was going to expire. And I ended up getting married. My wife is from France. So we had a very quick engagement because my paperwork was running out. And as I tell her now, 27 years later, I said, you know, you were my meal ticket to stay in France. We ended up staying there for 5 years and I had five different jobs. I had 19 jobs in total at Disney. So I'm a big fan of multiple experiences, diverse experiences. I think experience makes you flexible. It makes you able to deal with almost anything, and it makes life a lot more interesting. So every year I was kind of looking for the next job. What's the next move I'm going to make to learn more? And I was, you know, I was in frontline operations at Disneyland Paris. And then we decided to move back to the United States in 1997. And then I spent the next 22 years at Walt Disney World working in parks. I was in the resort hotels for about 6 years. And then I went back to parks and finished up in May of 2018. I actually gave my notice in March, and they thought I was crazy. People couldn't believe I was leaving. And my wife and I had actually, we weren't surprised because we had been talking about it for over a year. And, you know, we have three kids, and we knew the youngest was going to go off to college, and the other two were already out of the house. And so we just started talking about what the future held. And that by far was the most terrifying decision I've ever made, is to go leave Disney, because, you know, it's a great company. You learn a ton, but you really don't know if you can do what you do outside and do anything else. But what people don't see behind the scenes is, you know, every Christmas morning I was at the Magic Kingdom or I was at the theme parks, Easter weekends. It's extremely demanding. I learned a ton, but I really wanted to trade maybe the safety of a big company for maybe the freedom to do what we wanted to do now that we were empty nesters. So we made the leap. You know, I talked to my dad. My dad was with Marriott for 16 years and Disney for 16 years, and he retired back in 06. And he basically started writing books and doing podcasts and doing keynote speeches. So he was a very much of an inspiration to say, hey, Dan, you could definitely do this. And he's been mentoring me and helping us kind of figure out how to navigate being entrepreneurs, which we never were previously. And so we're 2 years into our new company, Cockrell Consulting. And Valerie is very talented. She worked in retail at Disney, and then she was a facilitator at the Disney Institute for about 6 years. And so we've teamed up now professionally. You know, we've done a pretty good job teaming up personally, being married for 27 years, but it was
raising three kids. So that's quite the teamwork effort too.
And raise three kids. And the fact I didn't know how tough it was going to be to figure out how to work together. That's a whole nother thing. So the past 2 years, we had some pretty tense moments because we operate pretty differently. But I think we've actually found a place now that we kind of respect each other professionally now. And we're doing, it's a lot of fun, because when I'm traveling, you know, I'm not like, people say, well, when you consult, you're in a hotel room all the time, you're traveling, you don't get to see your family. And basically we go everywhere together, everywhere we go, whether it's her gig or my gig or both our gigs, we travel together. So we're experiencing all this together, which has been a lot of fun. But, you know, there's moments where, all right, honey, we've had too much together time. I'm going upstairs for a while. I'll see you this afternoon.
Hey, I think through this COVID deal, we're all there. Because I know everybody's working from home. My wife's been working from home. I've been working from home. The kids are learning from home. Like, yeah, we've had so much family time together here. It's not been funny.
So, yeah, and you got to learn how to manage it.
Yeah. So let's back up a little bit and go some of the jobs, because you didn't come out and say your job titles there. And I think that's kind of what's going to resonate most with the listeners.
Yeah, when I got back from France, I was an operations manager. So I was at Epcot, running some of the international pavilions. Eventually I went to resorts and I was an operations manager at the All-Star Movies Hotel. So I took a year to learn how a hotel operates. And then after that was my first executive role. So I was promoted to be the general manager of the Wilderness Lodge and the Fort Wilderness Campground. And that was my first GM role. And that was fantastic. I mean, that property, I mean, you have a lake, you have recreation, you have camping, you have the Chippendale sing-along, you have the Hoop-De-Doo Review, you have an upscale restaurant at the Wilderness Lodge. So I learned a ton that 2 years.
Dan, what time frame was that?
I left parks in 2000, got to the All-Star in 2001, and then in 2003, 2004 was my first GM role at the Lodge.
Got it. Was the Boulder Ridge Villas built then, or the DVC wing, was it there when you were there?
Yeah, the whole other wing was there. So not only are you running a hotel, but you're running a Disney Vacation Club side of that. So that's why it was such a great training ground, because it was so diverse in all the different people you dealt with and all the different organizations that you interacted with along the way. And you know, as we always say, man, these guests act like they own the place. And when it's Disney Vacation Club, they do own the place. So they're very.
As a matter of fact, we do.
I'll tell you, one of the highlights for me, one of the stories was I was at the Wilderness Lodge in my office one day, and I got a call, and the operations manager at Fort Wilderness said there was two guests who wanted to meet with me. And, you know, when you hear that, you're like, oh, what did we do? So I said, yeah, absolutely. I'll meet with them. So they were actually down the lobby of the lodge. So I invited them up to my office and got them a cup of coffee. And they said, you know, we learned that you are in charge now of this hotel and the campground. I said, yes, I am. They said, well, we have a bus. They come down 6 months a year and travel across the United States. And they said, we just wanted to meet you because we've been coming here for, you know, over 30 years. And we know that you guys move around. And we knew Rylas, who was the last general manager here. And we knew Kevin, and they listed all the GMs who'd been there. And they said, we just want to let you know that, you know, welcome, but just don't mess around with stuff. you guys want to come in here and you want to change stuff because to show that you're, you know, really important. And there's a lot of great stuff here. And the new general manager always changes something up. So if you could just talk to people before you make decisions, because we've been coming here a lot longer than you have. You know, they weren't Disney Vacation Club members, but they said, we've been coming to this campground. We raised our kids. We have all these family memories. And we know things are going to change, but don't change them just for the sake of change, because we have a lot of great memories here. I felt the weight of the responsibility you have when you work at a place like Disney, because so many families have had so many memories over time, and you're passing through. So I did that for a couple of years, and then I moved on. I went back to the All-Star as the general manager. And that place, that was probably another 2 years where I learned, probably accelerated my development, my learning dramatically. Because, you know, if you haven't been to the All-Star, it has almost 6,000 rooms, right? You have those three themes. It's a motel style resort, campus style, 30 buildings over a 1 mile stretch, 6,000 rooms. So, you know, in the morning, you basically have 500 housekeepers showing up for work. I mean, it was like storming Normandy every morning. It was incredible, the logistics and just the volume of people you're dealing with. On any given night, we'd have, if we're full, we had 18 to 24,000 people sleeping at the All-Star. And as you can imagine, I could probably write a whole book about just being a GM at the All-Star, because, you know, generally people are pretty well behaved in public, like when they go to the parks. But when you go to the hotel at night and, you know, families are in those rooms together and there's all kinds of shenanigans going on. So it's and then you have all the Pop Warner and the football teams and the cheerleaders. And so there was a lot of really interesting. I got a lot of midnight and 2 a.m. pages about crazy stuff I couldn't even made up. But that I learned a lot about volume there. You know, at the All-Star, as I reminded my housekeeping team, if at the All-Star Resort, we clean 99.9% of the rooms every day correctly, we're going to have 60 dirty rooms at 99% perfection. And obviously, if you've ever worked at the front desk of a hotel, one family with a room that isn't cleaned properly is more than enough for one shift. So at 99%, you're at 60. So that's, you know, that's the kind of numbers you're dealing with at Disney. And you start to get used to this. You have to pretty much be perfect, because a rounding error is a lot of people when you have a resort that welcomes 50 million guests a year. So I learned a ton from that. And then at that point, I got an offer to go back to parks. I'd been gone from the parks for 6 years. So I went back to, I went to the Magic Kingdom as a general manager of merchandise, which is interesting at Disney. I didn't know much about merchandise. Don't even really enjoy shopping, but they said, look, we want you to, we're not looking for an expert merchandise. We're looking for someone who's going to come in and look at this business differently. And so I got into merchandise and I quickly learned how to trust my partners, the buyers, the product developers, the visual presentation team. I mean, there's a lot that goes into it. Buying product, developing product, pricing product. And when you work in operations, your job is be nice to guests and sell that product. And so I did that for about a year and a half. And then I became the general manager of attractions operations for the Magic Kingdom. And I did that for another year and a half. And then back in February of 2009, I got my first opportunity to become a vice president. And I got promoted to be the vice president of Epcot. And that was kind of surreal, because my wife had worked at the French Pavilion there. I had worked parked cars there. I had worked as a frontline manager in guest relations there. And now as the vice president of that park. And it was pretty cool. And my first day there, we got at my office, there's a call, and there was a lady in the parking lot who called and asked if I could come out and say hi. And so I went out there, and there was like two or three cast members that I'd worked with back in 1991 in parking. And they said, hey, we heard you're back. The manager showed up and freaked out, like, you can't call the vice president's office. They go, no, this is Dan. He's the college kid. So that was really neat. And it's funny, at Disney and a lot of places, you don't realize how important the experiences you're getting in the moment. Like when I was parking cars at Epcot, I never thought to myself, I'm going to come back here as a vice president. I mean, that you just don't imagine that. But when you go back, all of a sudden you're like, all right, I had pretty good relationships with people. I understand how this place works. And that was very helpful. So I did that for a couple of years. And then I got an offer to go to Disney's Hollywood Studios as the vice president. And I got there and we worked on a lot of the master planning for the Star Wars project, which was really, really interesting. I learned a ton from that. And I was there for 4 years. That's the longest I was ever in any one job. And then in 2015, they asked me if I would be interested to go run the Magic Kingdom. And that was fairly scary. It's kind of like the gym. It's when people say they're going to Walt Disney World, a lot of people are talking about the Magic Kingdom. And so I went there, and that last 3 years was kind of, I mean, one of the highlights of my career, just being able to operate a place that has 12,000 employees and has over 20 million guests coming every year. And I learned a lot about leadership, a lot about having to count on people and work with teams. You know, as you move up in organizations, when you're at the beginning, you really trust your own judgment on things. But as you move up in organizations, things become much more complex. And there's a lot of decisions you need to make that you don't necessarily have the technical knowledge to make. And that's when you just have to start trusting people's judgment and figure out and put the right people around you to counsel you and give you direction. And that's probably one of the most important things I've seen in leadership, because our ego a lot of times tells us that we're supposed to make decisions on our own. As leaders, we're supposed to know everything. But that's just not true. You need to count on your team to run whatever you're running. And I think a lot of leaders think that it's not good to be vulnerable, to ask questions. But I think it's a great leadership trait, and you make much better decisions.
Oh, absolutely. So I've heard a couple of touch points here, because one of the questions that I wanted to ask you was to just connect back with the audience. I think being the GM over the theme parks, the Boulder Ridge Resort, I'm a Copper Creek owner. I know a bunch of people who listen to this show are as well. And then we all love Boulder Ridge. So tying back into Disney Vacation Club and our experiences there are kind of key. Dan, in my job, I do customer service technology. And my question for you that I wanted answered was, where are some of the decisions that you have made that your fingerprints are still left in the park? I know planning of Galaxy's Edge you mentioned was one, but can you think of any other examples of walking through the park? And I guess we've got a virtual tour coming up that we'll hear more about that.
Yeah. Wow. I've never had the question posed that way. It's a neat way to say that. I'm trying to think about, you know, when it comes to, I guess, infrastructure, you know, the projects I was involved with, there was a lot happening, and you have Imagineering. I mean, you have a lot of different areas involved in those things. So I think a lot of things that I look at are the things that I had fingerprints on. You won't see there because they're gone now. You know, the big hat at Sorcerer's Hat at Disney's Hollywood Studios, that was. But when you say what's your fingerprints, well, I guess what it's important to know at Disney is everyone's interdependent, and there's really no decision necessarily that people make on their own. It's always a bunch of people weighing in on how things happen. But one story I'll tell you, and I'll try to answer your question because I do have an answer. But one thing I know that, you know, when I got the Magic Kingdom, the Be Our Guest restaurant was the only restaurant that had alcohol, right? Beer and wine. And I think that we started to see, you know, obviously you had two strong camps here. One was the purists who said, look, Walt Disney said we're never going to have alcohol in the castle parks. Well, he didn't say that because there was only one castle park when he was alive, but as they built Walt Disney World. And then there was other people that said, well, you know what? People today things have evolved, and people expect to have a glass of wine or a beer with their meal. And it's not about drinking a lot and being disruptive. It's about enjoying the meal. So they were able to influence that, to open it with beer and wine and very highly themed, you know, French beers and Belgian beers and French wines that kind of tied back to the Beauty and the Beast story. But then there was a point where we kept saying, look, we're ready to roll. When you're ready to put beer and wine in all the other table service restaurants at the Magic Kingdom, we get this question all the time. In fact, my wife, it was at the point I'd say, hey, why don't you come over to Magic Kingdom tonight and meet me for dinner? And she'd say, are you guys serving alcohol yet? No. Well, as soon as you are, let me know. Just come home.
Well, that's true. She's from a French culture and European culture. Wine with dinner is like water with us. Okay.
Yeah. Just civilized. So anyway, I got a call one day and they said, all right, we're ready to pitch this. And I said, pitch it to who? They said, Bob Iger. He has to approve this. This is that kind of decision. And so the food and beverage team had been working on a presentation and really to show him the value of this. And it's interesting. The whole conversation never even broached the topic of the profitability, because, you know, selling beer and wine is very profitable and it's going to be
absolutely
a nice for us. But we wanted to lead with, you know what, that's going to be an outcome. But here are all the reasons. Here's how many guests are asking us on a regular basis. Here's the profile now of the millennials and what they expect. And we really approached it from a guest experience standpoint. So I didn't go to that meeting, but they went in and they started talking. He said, look, I'm on board. Just tell me what it's going to look like and what you're going to do. So he had been briefed in advance. This was the way to go. And it was much less controversial, I think, than we thought it might be. But we introduced that. And that's a big deal to do that, because when you think about it, these restaurants weren't designed to have kegs and wine bottles. And there's a lot of work that has to be done, because once again, when you're handling these volumes, you run out of room to run this stuff. So we figured it out. And so today, if you ever go have a beer or a glass of wine in the restaurants at Magic Kingdom, you can say that I was highly supportive of that. And there you go. And I got another story for you in a little bit about beer, but we'll wait for that one. Here's how I answer the question, though, about fingerprints. I'm just the way I'm wired. I think my fingerprints are going to be on all the relationships I built there over time, and the people I mentored along the way, and the people I interacted with. That's what I got my thrill out of, was the leadership side, the people side. If it was up to me, I wouldn't go in another meeting again. I'd just be out in the park walking, talking with guests, interacting with our employees, asking them how to improve the experience. That's where I thought that the value was. And you know, that's where all the magic happens. It's between the frontline employees and the guests. And I loved to really focus on making that better. So Disney said this, you can dream and create, design all these things in the world, but it takes people to make that a reality. And that was where I focused my attentions. So I'd hope that, you know, there's going to be leaders I worked with early on who maybe now have gotten into executive roles. And when they tell a story about how they developed over time and their mentors, they'll mention me. And I think that's what I really value.
Yeah, that's a great answer there as well, because we leave our fingerprints everywhere, Dan. Every person that listens to this show has an impact and an influence, right? So our fingerprints are left everywhere. And that's really just kind of the gist of that question, is to drive home, hey, look, the decisions we make have ramifications. You mentioned the sorcerer's hat. Were you involved in putting it in or taking it out?
I was involved in taking it out. We knew that it was time for the studios. You know, we do these development projects on a rotating basis. So if you go back and you look at the new Fantasyland, right, that was the big investment at Magic Kingdom. And then they swung over to Animal Kingdom and built Pandora. And that needed to be, they needed more there. And then that brought the attention back to studios. And studios, you know, when you do these projects, it's like, not only what are we going to build, but what do we need to take out? And I think the time of the sorcerer's hat, its time had come, and started chipping away at it and taking out. I think I have a big giant star that was on it somewhere at my house in a closet somewhere. It's fun. So I literally have a piece of the hat, but yeah, I was there when it came out. Now I heard the story, you know, you never know how true these stories are, but I heard the story back in the day. This is going back, but there's Paul Pressler, right? He was the president of Disneyland. And eventually I think his title was chairman of Parks and Resorts when Michael Eisner was the CEO. And the story was, they were going to put this, they had this sorcerer's hat idea, and they didn't know where they were going to put it. And they had meeting after meeting after meeting. And the story was, one day Paul just got heard it, and they had a little maquette, right, of the parks. And they had a little mini sorcerer's hat. And he took the hat, and he looked around, he plopped it in front of the Chinese theater. He goes, all right, we're putting the hat there. We're done. So I don't know if it was that brief a conversation, but that's what I had heard. That's how the hat ended up in front of the Chinese theater for that celebration. And, you know, the other thing was the water tower, right? That was always an institution at the studios that we took down in the middle of the night so no one would notice.
Yeah, that hat was just, it had its time.
It did. I had no problem with the hat, but, you know, people always talk about that. What would Walt think about that? What would he think about all the changes? And I say, you know, this happens every time. Walt changed stuff all the time. He was putting stuff in and taking stuff out, and he had failures, and people forget about all that. I think when people pass, they become immortalized, and people say everything has to stop. And, you know, he said these theme parks, they're not museums. They're organic living places that need to change. And so it's interesting when people say, well, what would he like that today? I don't know what he'd like. I think he'd be thrilled about the technology that's been developed. But yeah, everything has its time and place. And every time has its time and place to be changed or move on. And that's the line you walk, especially at Disney. You know, guests tell us basically, we're going to come back because we want to see new and exciting things in the parks and resorts, but don't change anything because we have these memories we want to keep. And so it's really hard. People expect you're going to keep putting stuff in and never take anything out. And you end up running out of room.
Yeah, there's only so much space there.
Right.
Let's move on to some of the community questions here, Dan. So Jim wants to know, what new backstage behind-the-scenes tour or experiences would you like to see created for visitors?
Yeah, that's an interesting one. I lost track. There's so many tours. They may have some of these tours already, but one of the thrilling ones I was able to do, it wasn't a tour because I worked there at the time, but was to see how they just took care of all the animals at the Animal Kingdom and the barns and the operations there. I mean, it is incredible how they take care of these animals and all the technology they have to do that. So Animal Kingdom, you know, people are always really interested and thrilled to look at that. I was able to see a gorilla be put under and have his a cavity taken care of in his tooth. That's pretty impressive. You know, obviously you got the tunnel at the Magic Kingdom, the Utilidor. People love that kind of tour. There's probably, I think from my standpoint, if I was going to develop a tour, it wouldn't necessarily be a behind the scenes of like the parks. It would be a behind the scenes of how we operate the parks, you know, and you couldn't give away everything, but how does security do what they do? We have a group called Industrial Engineering. They're like the lifeblood of Disney. I always had an industrial engineer sitting next to me when I was making decisions because they would help you think about the investment, that they, you know, you're moving people around, how many people can stand in front of the castle to see the projection show, and they could calculate do all that from a PDF and a map, and they could give you all kinds of incredible information. So it seems like if I could gather four or five people who are really great with analytics and could present and talk about how you figure out how you schedule people, how you do your planning, how you decide how wide the sidewalks need to be, there's a lot of really cool details behind that. I don't think it would be for everybody, but whenever I go on the cruise line, I spend my whole time talking with the managers and the employees. I'm like, how does this thing operate? You know, how do you do your shifts? Where do you guys sleep? I mean, I love the operational side of things and just to get to see how it's all brought together.
Yeah, that is a fascinating backstory. And that's a great answer there. If listeners want to go back to episode 11 of the podcast, Nick Cotton, a former Disney industrial Imagineer who started DVC Resale Market, I actually have an interview with him. And so that's a great line of thought. And I would sign up for that tour, Dan. I would in a heartbeat.
All right. Well, we got one. We'll keep seeing if we can make this happen.
Joe wants to know what ride or resort should have been built that didn't get built.
Well, there's a few. And once again, some of these I know, and some of these were rumored. They may be urban legends. But there was actually one of them was in my book. I'll tell that story. But at one point, there was a hotel that was going to go in kind of in that piece of land in front of the Contemporary. If you go across the road there, right up to Bay Lake, no, actually it's Seven Seas Lagoon. If you go right up to the front there, it was this idea that it was going to be sort of a Mediterranean resort. And I always thought that was a really neat concept to put another hotel in there because you're right next to the Magic Kingdom, you know, the fireworks, the proximity. I don't know if it would have gotten tied into the monorail or not, but there was certainly talk there of building a hotel. There were a couple things. So one was, and like I said, I talked about this in my book under strategic planning. Every park has it, we would call it a needs assessment every year. And so everyone gets to participate in the needs assessment, and they basically do an analysis of the park: food and beverage, retail, sales, marketing, finance, industrial engineering, Imagineering, research. Everyone gets to say, what does this park need? What are its needs? What works in this park and what needs to be added to this park to make it more profitable, more compelling, to improve the experience? And so it's really cool when we do that, because back in the 80s and 90s, you know, if you're a vice president of a park, it was kind of like the Wild West. If you had an idea, you'd put a project team together, you'd go come up with the idea and pitch it. And if you could convince your boss and the board to build it, they'd say go, and you'd just build it. And it wasn't a whole bunch of strategy behind it. But what we'd realized is when you get so big as a company, you have to have a much better way to prioritize how you're spending your money. Because not only are you competing with the other parks, but you're competing with the other hotels, the Disney Cruise Line, the consumer products, the production studios. And so we came up with this methodology of this needs assessment. And it was sort of like the guidelines. So I got a call from Imagineering, and they said they had just been in a meeting with John Lasseter, and they had been brainstorming, and they came up, and he had had this on his mind for a long time, but he said, we want to build a Monsters door coaster at the studios. And, you know, if you've seen Monsters and you're into coasters, you can imagine how cool that could be. You're flying around and the doors are going and monsters are coming in and out, and you're in kids' bedrooms seeing them scare the kids. And I mean, it's just the whole thing. So, you know, I love the idea, but because we had this needs assessment, I was able to say, well, look, I love that idea, but let me remind you what the needs assessment says. Our needs assessment says right now we only have two attractions that don't have height requirements or have very low height requirements: Midway Toy Story Mania and the Great Movie Ride. And basically everything else either has a height requirement, Star Tours or Rock and Roller Coaster or Tower of Terror, or they're a show. So the needs assessment said we clearly need more family attractions with a 42-inch height requirement or no height requirement. And I said, as much as I love the door coaster, that's not what this park needs right now. Our guests don't need another coaster. And we all agreed on that. So it was kind of
incredible. Oh, you're killing me here, Dan. But you're 100% right, okay?
Right. But the fact that you're able to push back to the highest people in the company because you all agreed together that you had a strategy, I think that's one of the reasons that Disney's done so well, it had that discipline. Because there's, you know, you could have someone with an ego saying, look, I don't care what your strategy is, I want this built, and then push it through. But it wouldn't improve the guest experience. And if you start losing track of that, that's the beginning of the end. You're not building this stuff for yourself. You're building it for the people who are visiting. So that was, that should have been built, wasn't built. Maybe one day it will be built. We'll see. And then just the other one thing I'll hit on is, you know, when I worked on the master planning at studios for Star Wars, the whole thing I worked on never came to light. Because when I was working on this, we were going to build Tatooine. And we were going to build a Star Wars land that was the ones we knew from 1976 and 1978 in the 80s, because that's what we were thinking about. And Kathleen Kennedy, who was George Lucas's protege and took over Lucasfilms, met with Bob Iger one day and said, look, I'd like to make sure, as we're looking at this design, you all need to understand there's more Star Wars stories ahead of us than behind us. And it's going to be fun to open a Tatooine land, but those stories aren't going to be relevant to the upcoming generations, because they're not going to see, they're going to see those movies, but the characters we're going to develop moving forward and the storylines are going to be, that's what they're going to be thinking about. So do you want to build it for the 50 and 60 year olds that remember Star Wars, or do you want to build it for the incoming generation? So they basically land on Galaxy's Edge, which is in a certain degree a nondescript village on a planet somewhere in the Star Wars universe. And you can put anything there because it wasn't part of a movie. And so you kind of take the pressure off by saying, this is a planet that in the future we can do anything we want with it. And I thought that was really smart to think about the future. It's the same way that Pandora at Animal Kingdom was designed. Basically, the story of Pandora is that land is 50 years after the last movie. Because, you know, there's four more movies coming of Avatar. And so you don't want to build something that after the second movie, people say, well, this isn't like the story anymore. So you got to think about the future and design that way. And I think they were real smart to do that.
Yeah, no, but again, that kills me because I was the guy out there going, hashtag not my Star Wars.
Okay. Yeah, and it wasn't, but the millennials that are coming up now, they're the ones that are going to decide where they're going to spend their money. And if, you know, we tell our kids all the time, hey, have you guys ever seen this movie, you know, this 80s movie, Pretty in Pink or 16 Candles? We've never seen it. Oh, it's a classic. And they're like, yeah, whatever. I'm like, no, really, you're missing out. But it's hard. You want to let them know. But I think it's the same with Star Wars. It's not going to be as relevant necessarily to the people who are going to have the money to make these travel decisions in the future.
Yeah, I get it. But at the same point in time, it was current for like 4 days. From when Galaxy's Edge opened up or Rise of the Resistance opened up, and then the final movie came out. Now that the final movie's out, it's kind of like, wait a minute now, we're kind of out of date again.
Yeah.
So I'm interested to see how they're going to advance the storyline, because that's what I had heard. They were going to do that. But that's some interesting backstory there, Dan.
Yeah.
I think you led into this next question, so it's a great transition here. Sam wants to know what type of financial equations are driving the opening of the parks, like restaurant close times. And do you think the parks now are operating at a profit? And I think it ties back into your needs assessment as well.
Yeah. And is directly related to sort of the pandemic right now?
It sounds like it from that level.
Yeah. Here's my opinion. When Walt Disney World made the decision to reopen, we had the cases here were flat. and it looked like we were in good shape and it was flat and we'd hit our peak. And then obviously it took off again and has risen. I would imagine if they knew that that was going to happen, we would have delayed opening the parks because, you know, to be a hotspot state in the country with the COVID-19 and have theme parks open maybe isn't the best message. But what I can tell you is that the parks are, you know, I went there a couple weeks ago. If anyone's going to execute running a safe operation in a pandemic, it's Disney. And when I got there, you know, just down to when they park your car, they put a space between your car and the next car over. And then once people leave, then they fill in the other spots because once people are gone. So they start with social distancing in the parking lot. As you're coming through, you know, they talk about how important you have to have your masks on the whole time. The social distancing's put in place. They put infrastructure in place and queue lines to keep people separated. So I would tell you, just like hurricanes in Florida, Walt Disney World now is probably the safest place to be in Florida because you're not going to find anyone out there without a mask and not socially distanced. And the cast, the employees have been trained to really hold people accountable to that, but do it in a very nice way. But yeah, when we were there, you know, as I talked to a group yesterday, the financial structure of theme parks are based on a big fixed cost. If you're going to open the park for one guest, it's the same cost as opening it for 10,000 guests because you have to open up the attractions, open the restaurants, open everything up. And so when there's a lot of volume, these parks make a lot of money because once you get over that break-even point, almost every dollar goes to the bottom line after that is profit. But when you don't have the volume, it's very problematic. You can't cut your way to profitability. So what I've seen is they've changed a little bit of their operating practices. There are limited table service restaurants open. So they're saying, you know what, we're only open enough table service to accommodate the lower attendance level. And it's the same with the fast food restaurants and the merchandise. And they don't have the parade right now and the fireworks. And a lot of that's because of social distancing. But I've seen they've done a pretty good job taking out as many costs as they can and still keeping the experience intact. And to tell you the truth right now, if you like attractions, you like to ride, this is the time to go because, man, there's almost not a line for everything. You can walk on in very short wait times. Now, as we told people, if you come to Florida and go to Disney, you might have to quarantine for 2 weeks before you go back home. So keep that in mind. But if they're making a profit, it's pretty lean right now. And in my opinion, until a vaccine comes out, you know, sports stadiums, concert venues, anywhere that you have a lot of concentration of people is going to be problematic until a vaccine is invented or is distributed. Because unless you can take that off the table, that danger, that's always going to be on people's minds. Now, you're going to see a lot of younger people out there. They've read they're a lot less susceptible to this. They're willing to take that risk. But, you know, you have the older populations who realize they're much more at risk. And so it's going to be a while, I think, before we're going to see the normal come back.
Yeah, it's definitely a weird time right now. And I've got friends on both sides of the fence here. Some people are saying I'm staying home and other people are going, yeah, but I feel safer at Disney than I do my local grocery store. Okay, because I know they're going to do it to a higher level of standards. So yeah. I've got friends on both sides of that one and I respect all of their opinions. For me, yeah. I'm probably going to end up coming in November back to Terry Weaver's The Thing event, which I'm hoping we'll see you at. If you're in town, from what I'm hearing from Terry.
Sure.
This next question is pretty long, but it's talking about the relationship between DVC and the theme parks and other Disney units. Now, I'll lead with my thoughts from talking with enough people I think are in the know, but it seems like DVC is their own independent financial company, so to speak. It's Disney, but they're their own unit, and the parks are Disney, but they're their own unit. And so the two of them have to negotiate back and forth. Did I get that right, Dan?
Yes. Now, when it comes to legal entities, I'm not quite sure how they're set up. But the rules and regulations and laws that guide the Disney Vacation Club, you know, is very specific. And the dues have to go back to infrastructure improvements. And there's a calculation of how do you calculate what the costs are that go back to Disney Vacation Club versus the Walt Disney World Resort. So there's definitely, they are run very much like two different companies. Although the synergy and the collaboration between them obviously is very high. And so you have, if you're at Walt Disney World, you're thinking, all right, you know, Disney Vacation Club's getting the profits from their rooms, but also I want to make sure I'm keeping in mind how to yield management my hotels so that if, you know, Disney Vacation Club rooms aren't available, how do I get the points and translate those to fill up my rooms, just like I would bringing in sports teams or convention groups or marathoners or food and wine people. It's just another group that's going to buy rooms, and it's another group who's going to come into the theme parks and provide park attendance. So we're always walking that line. And, you know, the vacation club, one of their big things is, you know, you say, well, do you reward loyalty? And I that's something I dealt with a lot when I was working with the vacation club properties is, you know, talk about loyal. We paid a lot of money to be here for the next, you know, for many decades in the future. What are you going to give us that's above and beyond what other people are getting? And so there's a negotiation process that happens there. And if you're a vacation club member, you know that you see benefits change and over time. Do I get a merchandise discount? Do I get a food and beverage discount? I think that Disney Vacation Club, when I was there, did a really good job of creating events so people felt like they were being respected and taken care of and for their contribution and their loyalty to the company. So it was always a very interesting meeting because every, you know, we had an annual meeting that I would attend with the head of Disney Vacation Club as a general manager of the Wilderness Lodge. And, you know, people would show up and it was like a homeowners association meeting and people had questions and complaints and that kind of thing. And I thought it was a lot of fun to hear that. It was a much different experience because you don't have those kind of meetings with guests of a hotel, but these are people that are coming back again and again, and they know that their money is going into the investment of this infrastructure. And just like a homeowners association, the more you upkeep it, the more it's going to be worth. And so let's make sure that we're holding the owners accountable or the managers, which is Disney, to make sure that it's the best it can be.
Absolutely. And there's another part of that as well from the Moonlight Magic events where DVC essentially leases out the theme parks for a night. Can you talk to us a little bit about that part?
Yeah, I mean, that's a fantastic event. And I thought that was a really smart way to do it because, you know, at the end of the day, it's not only what is the event, but what's the emotional connection that you get after that? You know, Disney, as my wife likes to talk about, we talk to groups, we say, you know, Disney is has figured out how to go through your heart on the way to your wallet. When you are emotionally connected to a product, you will pay for it. And whether it's Disney or Apple or whatever, you know, whatever brand that you really enjoy. So Moonlight Magic, I thought that was a great concept because this idea, I call it bragging rights, right? When you go home and people go, oh man, you're that vacation club. You're one of those Disney nuts. And you say, well, yeah, but here's what I get out of it. And you do the financial calculation. If you go to Disney every year, you save, I don't know, it's an incredibly good deal over time if you decide that's where you want to be every year. But the Moonlight Magic is, hey, we get the park to ourselves too. And that's, you know, that's a pretty big, I would imagine there may be people that put them over the edge when they said, okay, I'm thinking about Vacation Club and go, hey, well, every year we close the park and you get to have it to yourself.
Like 12 times.
when you hear that, you're like, now even people may not even show up for that. You know, they may not even be in town, but it's the marketing part of that that goes, man, that visual is pretty cool to me. We're that important that they close the park down and we get to have our own time there. And I think it's a pretty powerful message when you're trying to sell something.
It is. It's a really key benefit of becoming a Blue Card member is getting the access to those parties. And yep.
Exclusivity.
Yeah, exclusivity there. And you look at this and you go, because I was in Disneyland one night when Farmers Insurance rented out the park and they had their own Moonlight Magic. So I know they come back into major corporations and rent out the parks at times. And it makes sense that DVC would come back in and rent out the park for its members as well.
Yeah, and those corporations, they're paying a lot of money for that too.
Well, hopefully you guys are giving DVC a little bit of a in the family discount here or something.
Absolutely. But DVC is such a valuable group to us because you're basically getting people to say, opt in. That's volume we can count on every single year moving forward. And when companies know that they have, they lower their risk because they know that the people are committed to come back. It helps everybody. It helps us make better financial decisions, growth decisions. The great thing about DVC is we get the money up front. You know, having learned about finance and like, it's always better to have the money now than later. So get the money now. It's worth more.
Yeah. I've often thought that the highest paid people in all of Disney should be the DVC sales guides because they're really locking in. They're not selling one vacation. They're selling 50 every time somebody buys a contract. There's some serious revenue there. To the DVC guides that are out there, props to you guys for helping make everything happen, because nothing happens in world until somebody sells something. So I've got all the respect in the world for those guides. And I think the vast majority of them do a great job as well.
Yep, they do.
Well, this is a question that comes up quite often in the fan community. And Ryan wants to know, do you think Disney is leaning too heavily on existing IP in its current attractions and resort designs, or should it look to develop more new original concepts? Or is it better to promote the existing IP in the parks and the resorts?
Wow, that's a great question. I would, I think the way the world is wired today, the amount of intellectual property, or just the amount of content just that's out there with technology now, what, every 6 months or every year, there's the new app. Now it's TikTok, which I've seen a couple of videos, but there's people are creating their own original content, and people are becoming, social media darlings just by doing stuff that's really compelling for people. So I think the ability to deliver concepts now has been democratized, and people can do that on an equal basis across wherever they are. When it comes to Disney, we talk about the fact that this synergy that we do is always really important. Is there an emotional connection with whatever experience you're having? That I would say, we keep coming back to that again and again, the emotional connection. In fact, when we talk to guests and we talk about what they want and what they need, they say, well, we want a great vacation. We want family time. We want a clean hotel room. We want to go to the parks. But what we need is you to make us feel special, treat us as individuals, respect us, and be knowledgeable about how we're enjoying our time here. So it keeps coming back to emotional connection. So I would say, I think it's a great idea to use the IP, because when you come to the parks, you've seen the movie, maybe you bought the merchandise, and now you get to be immersed in that experience. And so if you're a big Guardians of the Galaxy fan, you want more Guardians of the Galaxy. Now, if you're not a big Guardians of the Galaxy fan, then the IP is not really going to matter to you. You're just going to say, I just want to be on a really cool roller coaster and have this cool experience. So I know that there's been some people criticizing maybe like Epcot, because Epcot was the concept of that was really about, it wasn't just about a theme park. It was about how the future of humans could be better. How do you develop cities where people can live and work and thrive and play together? And that was the original, as they say, the experimental prototype community of tomorrow. That was the concept. So Future World Now, I know the idea for a long time was, the land pavilion, the living seas. When you think about energy used to be there. So it really was bigger than just a theme park. It was talking about the world. And now people are saying, well, now you're kind of using all these IP and this theming to make it more of a theme park. And I don't know what the right answer is. I know Disney's going to continue to have a very optimistic message about the future. Walt Disney was a very optimistic guy, and that's why I think a lot of people were attracted to what he did. And for me, the World Showcase at Epcot is the heartbeat of that place anyway, when you have all the people from all over the world sharing their their nationalities. But I would say that question, there's probably as many opinions as there are people who will weigh in on that. Is it too commercialized or not? Is it too, Disney, Tom Staggs was our chairman previously, and his line was, whatever we do, we have to add to the brand. We can't take advantage of our brand. We have to enhance it. Because you see that happen sometimes where people will be successful with something and then they'll just dump a bunch of merchandise on the market to try to make a quick buck. And that doesn't last over time. So there's a certain amount of discipline to make sure you're not over commercializing, you're delivering really high quality experiences, but that the emotional connection a lot of times will be the IP, and they just got to pick the right ones.
That's a great answer. I'm a huge fan of the IPs as well. I just get it from a marketing standpoint of they're spending all of this money to promote the next Frozen movie. What else can they attach onto that to enhance the experience as well? It's like momentum. They've already got the momentum going behind the IP. Let's keep it going with some other things that, to your point, are going to enhance the experience and continue the momentum.
Yep. Well said. Exactly.
So this next question comes back in and it ties into that, but The context of this is the purchase of Fox, The Simpsons on Disney Plus. And Ken wants to know, do you think that Disney could be losing some of the innocent family wholesomeness? And tied to that is, what, if anything, would Walt be displeased with today? Another huge fan discussion that goes on out there in the community.
Yeah. Wow. These are tough ones. I think the purchase of Fox, and you think about what the coming back to IP is, Disney certainly represents this idea of quality entertainment and has to walk that line. You know, as I tell people, Universal's very smart. They do things that Disney won't or can't do. You know, Halloween Horror Nights, that's probably one of the most scariest things I've ever been to. I mean, talk about the opposite of a not so scary Halloween party with Mickey Mouse and Chip and Dale. You go down the street to Universal and, you know, there's little kids running around with you with chainsaws. It's terrifying. But Universal knows that Disney can't do that because it's just too much. So they're going to take advantage of that. So I think over time, Disney's going to be held to a different level of accountability. And I'll take some of the park examples that I know that we've done, and I think that'll translate eventually maybe to the Disney Plus side. But if you go back many years, maybe eight years ago, maybe less than that, we recognized the fact that Pirates of the Caribbean, you know, the one of the scenes was a woman being auctioned off, and that had been around for decades. But someone started to say, you know what, if I'm a mom today, I don't know if I'm okay with that anymore. And so we didn't want to make a big deal out of it, but we said, you know, maybe we should have we can still have a great entertaining message here and not have to do it that way. And now we have, as we call her, name is Big Red, and she's a woman pirate, right? And she's in charge. And we changed that whole scene. The one that obviously is top of mind for people is Splash Mountain. You know, we that has been something for years we thought about. You know, the Song of the South has not been released for retail in a long time, and it probably will never get released because just the way it was portrayed at the time isn't acceptable today. And now Princess and the Frog going in is a much better storyline, and the attraction will stay the same in terms of its experience. It'll just have a different storyline. So I would imagine Disney will decide which things they want to discontinue and which things they want to keep going forward. Usually we do things we phase things out. We don't make decisions overnight. We don't want to bring a lot of, you know, discussion to certain things. And so you may see that phased out. I know that someone, I'm trying to remember her name, she does one of the voices on, I think, The Simpsons. They are changing the way she does that. So society is continuing to evolve and change, and Disney will continue to evolve and change with it. You can't buy a musket today or one of those pirate, you know, the old hammer guns in the park. Because with all these shootings, we wanted to get away from that. So this is going to be a continued conversation. This will never be done. You're not always going to make the best decisions, but I would tell you that Disney does want to think about it's being, you know, Bob Iger, his goal is for Disney to be the most admired company in the world. And that's a pretty tall order. In order to do that, you need to make sure you have the right things you're putting out. And so I would imagine that you may see some things phased out, and you'll see different decisions on programming when it comes to Disney Plus. It'll be more than what people expect. I think on the Walt piece, I don't think, you know, it's funny. I don't know if everyone likes to talk about what would he like or not like about Disney. I think it's more of a big question. What would he like or not like about society or where the world went? You know, a lot of the outcomes today of how companies operate is because of politics. It's about economics. The world keeps developing and evolving and changing, and companies evolve and change with it. And I think some of the opportunities he had when he was alive or didn't have, he wouldn't have today, or he would not be accessible to him. So I really have a tough time answering this question, because his thing was, we're here to create immersive environments for people to escape reality and families to spend time together. And I think my opinion is that the Walt Disney Company's done a pretty good job keeping that focus and keeping that in line. And something that maybe some of the listeners know about, we talk about our four keys, our quality standards in the theme parks: safety, courtesy, show, and efficiency. Those are the four criteria we use for decision-making, and we train our employees to use for decision-making. And I think he would be very pleased that we're still using the same criteria than when he was running Disneyland.
Yeah, that's a great answer to that question. The world changes, and Walt was a proponent of change. So So to say he would like or dislike something, it comes up all the time. So I figured I'd get you to answer that. But great answer there, Dan. Thanks. And so Sandy wants to know, what's been some of the best and worst management principles carried over from Walt Disney World to the international parks?
Wow, that's a good one. So one of the stories, let's go back to beer and wine. You know, we opened Disneyland Paris with no alcohol because that was the way it was going to be. That lasted, I think, like 3 months. Friends were like, look, we don't care what Walt Disney thought. You're in France now, and this is part of our culture. So that was put in there pretty quickly, and we kind of got over that. So that was one. I think we've had such incredible learnings. Once again, this could be a whole book on when you're building international sites. How do you think through all the differences? I think Disneyland Paris was probably one of the biggest learnings in things you should do and things you shouldn't do. We brought, I think that the thinking at the time back in the 90s was, we're just going to lift Walt Disney World. We're going to lift Disney and just plop it in France. And we're just going to kind of run it like we run it here and everything will be good. And then you have all the learnings along the way. And you realize that people, their preferences are different. The price points that they are willing to pay are different. What they value is different. And you start making all those changes. So simple stuff. Like when we first opened the parks, we had the shirts with the giant Goofy on the front, like we like to wear in the United States, in your face. And there, you know, the French and the Europeans weren't buying that. And there it's like, I want to have a polo with a Goofy that's like 1 centimeter wide, very subtle on my shirt. That's what we want. And so we learned to start developing products that would work in that market. Just that, like I said, the way they behaved, the fact that we thought people would come stay at Disneyland Paris for a week. It's like, well, no, there's only one theme park. We're not going to stay for a week. We're going to go see Paris. Did you forget Paris is next door? That's called competition. So we really reworked the whole marketing campaign to say, okay, we're not a long-term destination. We expect people to come for 1 or 2 nights and then they'll be gone again. And once you start realizing that, you start to change the way you deliver. We assumed that guests would go to the parks and have breakfast. And so we built very little capacity in the hotels in France for breakfast capacity. And when people said, we want to have breakfast at the hotel, that was a big problem because you've already built the infrastructure. So a lot of times now when they're really busy, they have box breakfast at the elevators and you take it back to your room and have it there because they just didn't behave the way we thought they would behave. So when we opened Hong Kong and Shanghai, I think we took a big step forward in doing it even better. Instead of sending 1,000 Americans to Hong Kong, we brought 1,000 Chinese to Florida and they trained for 6 months and worked in the operation to learn how a Disney theme park operated. And then they went back to China and then figured out how to operate it there. I think it was much easier to teach them the, 70, 60 years of Disney culture than 2,000 years of Chinese culture. And so that was the way we did that. And Bob Iger recognized that. He said, I want the parks in China to be, I think he said, distinctly Chinese and uniquely Disney. So he knew that you had to have both of those and you couldn't tell the same fairy tales because those don't necessarily translate. People in China have different fairy tales and they had different stories. And it was up to us to figure out what those stories were and deliver those to them. They had to rotate Hong Kong Disney 2.5 degrees because they had brought in a feng shui expert to look at the park and make sure all the energy flowed through the park the right way. And they do that in every, in these big Asian cities, you have a feng shui expert because if you don't do that, it's going to be bad karma. And so they had to actually rotate the park and all the plans to make sure that happened. It was very expensive, but someone had not thought about that necessarily. So it's just, so many cool cultural things that happen. And overall, I think Disney mostly gets it right. And as long as they keep thinking, we're here to entertain families, we're here to have children to have magical experiences, and what that looks like will be different in every place they go. But at a base level, we're going to deliver it differently with our principles that we know are right. And I think that's where they've been successful. But yeah, lots of learnings.
Yeah, lots of great management techniques and tips there. And speaking of that, let's pivot over and start talking about your new book. It's called How's the Culture in Your Kingdom?
Yes. Well, we are excited about this. It's been a couple years in the making. When I first started writing it, I was trying to figure out, do I want a ghostwriter to write it or do I want to write it and help have someone help me edit it? And I went plan B. And so my wife and I actually both wrote it. She probably wrote about half of it. I got burnt out at one point. And I was like, I can't do this. She said, I'll take over for a while. Tell me some stories. So it was a team effort. But I just thought about, you know, what are the things, you know, working at Disney for 26 years, clearly we focus on culture. When you create the right environment for your employees, you're much more likely for them to be happier, perform at a higher level. That will translate to better customer service. The customers have an excellent experience. They're more likely to come back again and recommend you. And that's the value chain. So I wanted to really hone in on the importance of culture. So I started writing down things. What do I know? What are the things I know? And over time, I had people help me kind of bucket these things. Where I landed was in three buckets. The first bucket was leading yourself. The second was leading your team. And the third was leading your organization. And we kept the leading yourself. We were going to put it at the back of the book, but we decided to leave it at the front because that's where it belongs. Because a lot of people don't realize how important it is to take care of yourself before you do anything else. And simple stuff. It's all the stuff that we know, but we still don't do all the time. Eating right, getting enough sleep, getting enough exercise, managing stress, being organized. What are all the things that are totally in your control that you just through discipline or willpower, you can control to put yourself in the best position to be able to perform? Think of professional athletes. You know, they have psychologists to help them visualize, to build their confidence. They have certain diets. They have certain workout routines. You never hear a professional athlete brag they only got 4 hours of sleep before a big game because that would be irresponsible. But somehow we do that in business. And we're dealing with the same stresses as professional athletes do. Maybe not the physical stresses, but the emotional stresses of running our businesses. So that's a big theme. The second part is leading team. Once, as we talked earlier in the podcast, you have to have a great team around you to be able to make good decisions over time. Leading your organization is more traditional business ideas. And then we added the last section that we thought was important, leading change. Today, people know what they need to do, but getting everyone on board to move forward is really problematic. And so I shared some stories in the book around my opinions and my experiences about leading change, either successfully or unsuccessfully. But sometimes if you don't get all your people on the bus, even if you have the best idea and you can't execute it, then it's a failure. I use lots of stories in the book. People remember stories. Walt Disney was the original storyteller. So I made sure I put lots of stories for people to retain. I not only talked about what went well, I put some big mistakes I made in there. I think that's important to share. You're going to make mistakes along your career, bad judgment. And then I have a section called Fast Track the Results. So I put a bunch of, if you want to start being better at this tomorrow, here are five things you can start doing behaviorally. And that's where the accountability comes in. So we're pretty excited about it. And I think it's going to help people who are running big companies, small companies. If you're one person and you have one employee, I think it's still helpful. It has nothing to do with the size of your organization. It has everything to do with how you think about dealing with people and leadership and building a culture where people feel comfortable and valued.
Dan, that's some great answers. When does the book release?
It will be released officially August 11th through bookstores, Amazon, et cetera. So you can find it there. And I'm also selling it on my website, culture-kingdom.com. Or you can go to dancockrell.com and find a link there. And I'm selling it and shipping from here. And I include some digital bonuses. And if you're interested in just buying it online, you can pre-order it on Amazon or wherever you buy your books.
Awesome. I'll be glad to put a link in the show notes where people can easily find that as well. Now, Dan, we didn't get to all of our questions today, but I know we've got a couple of opportunities because you're going to co-host a night on Mouse Quiz with us and get some more of these Disney leadership level of questions to come back in on Mouse Quiz. That'll be happening on Friday, August 7th. And then on the 9th at 9 o'clock at night as well, you're going to be joining us for the live. And hopefully we can get to some more of these questions from the listeners and more wisdom from you on those two venues.
Well, that would be great. I love getting on and talking to people. That's one of the things I miss not being in the theme parks every day is having lots of people around me and all these interactions. So I jump anytime I can get on and chat with people about this. So thanks for the invitation.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to it. And then do we have a rough estimated time frame when the audio version of the book will be out?
I think it's probably going to be in late August. So a couple weeks after the paper copy becomes available. We're finishing up the audio version. Jody Mayberry, my partner, who does my podcast with me, I did the introduction and he did the reading of the book. And we're almost done with that. And it'll be ready to roll in the next few weeks.
That's awesome. Because I know we're podcast listeners. So the Audible edition of the book might just resonate as well with people. I know I'm looking forward to that. And speaking of which as well, how can listeners get more Dan Cockrell follow up with you? I know the book is coming out, but you mentioned your podcast, Come Rain or Shine, which I'm a huge fan on. Listen to it every Thursday, right when the episode drops.
Yeah, we just celebrated our 100th episode. And, you know, Jody had told me when we started this, he said, hey, I'm ready to do the podcast with you, but I just want to let you know the average podcast only goes 7 episodes before people run out of content. So he put the gauntlet down. I'm like, we are never going to stop. Come Rain or Shine, but we do that every Thursday and talk about all kinds of different topics. And then dancockrell.com is my website. And my wife just redesigned or built a new website called cockrellconsulting.com. So eventually we're going to transfer everything over to that site. But you can go to either of those sites to see everything we're working on, our contact information. We have some free resources. There's some videos on there. You can find out about my much better half who does, she does great public speaking and seminars and that kind of thing. So we're both on there, cockrellconsulting.com.
That's awesome. Yeah. So thank you so much for joining us today, Dan. And I look forward to interacting more with you, with the listeners, between Mouse Quiz and our live show coming up on August 7th and August 9th at 9 p.m. Facebook.com/MyDVCPoints.
Cool.
Well, that puts another episode in the books. I'd like to thank our sponsors for season 4 of the MyDVC Points platform, DVC Resale Market, DVC Rental Store, Monera Financial, and Incredible Vacation Homes. At this point in the show, I normally come up with some kind of an ask for you, but I'm going to double down and use my ask this week to come back in and ask you to either pre-order Dan's book, How's the Culture in Your Kingdom, or at least come back in and meet us on Friday night for Mouse Quiz. We'll be running 3 sets of 10 questions, one on Magic Kingdom history during his tenure there, one on Hollywood Studios history during his tenure there, and then one on the Wilderness Lodge. I hope you join us Friday night at youtube.com/MyDVCPoints for Mouse Quiz to go over these trivia questions where you'll get more time to hear stories and interact with Dan. And then he's also coming back with us on Sunday night for the Community Hall Live podcast for more opportunities to come back in and just answer listener questions, explain a little bit more about virtual tour, and perhaps give us a little sample of it there on the show. Thanks for tuning in, everybody. Have a magical day.
Ladies and gentlemen, please watch your head and step as you exit, and take small children by the hand.
Aw, cheer up, Dad. You know I'll come back. With DVC.
My DVC Points is an unofficial Disney-inspired podcast created by fans of Disney Vacation Club. The thoughts expressed in this podcast are personal opinions and personal experiences. My DVC Points is not affiliated with Disney Vacation Club, the Walt Disney Companies, or any subsidiaries. We encourage listeners to contact their DVC guide or member services for official DVC policies.